This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're having a great Tuesday. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. What a tragedy we woke up to today at about 1 o'clock in the morning. The Francis Scott Key Bridge was hit by a barge, the Dahlia, and it collapsed. At least seven people are thought to be missing, as many as 20. Two have been recovered. One is in serious condition. The other one declined medical attention. But you have a tractor trailer that went right into the ocean. It's going right into the harbor, I should say. A lot of questions. You see the Dahlia losing its, it seems to be losing its power. You see the lights go off and then come back on, go off and then come back on, and it slams right into the pillar. And down goes the bridge. So we'll follow that story as it develops. There's a press conference coming up in about 25 minutes. Brett Baer is standing by. Dan Senor on the latest with Israel. But let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting.
But we've also said election deniers, is not just they can do that on our airwaves, but that they can do that as one of us, as paid contributors to our sacred airwaves.
Sacred airwaves, that's good. It's when your talent knows more than your management. That's what's happening at NBC. Meltdown. Ronna McDaniel hired NBC has caused a massive network mutiny, and I just don't get it. I'd be happy to watch. I'll take it in, but I just don't understand.
Number two.
Number one, it's a non-binding resolution. So there's no impact at all on Israel and Israel's ability to continue to go after Hamas. It does not represent a change at all in our policy.
And John Kirby knows that's not true. Why he says stuff like that, I don't understand. Biden breaks with Israel, Netanyahu breaks with Biden. As at stake, peace in the Middle East. Who is happy? Our enemies, Iran, China, and Russia.
Number one.
All of these different cases, so ridiculous, the cases, every one of them is ridiculous. They're all trying to damage Trump as much as possible. It's having the reverse effect, but maybe someday it won't. I don't know. But it's having the reverse effect.
Much to the chagrin of detractors, former President Donald Trump has more than survived his manic Monday. His bond reduced, Truth Social goes public, bolstering his bank account by billions. But he will have his first criminal trial in April. Let's bring in Brett Baer to talk about this. Brett, welcome back.
Hey, bro.
Hey, Brett, do you know this bridge, the first off, on the breaking news that we've been covering all morning?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it gets a lot of usage, and obviously it could have been worse, I suppose, but it's a horrible thing. And obviously we'll see where they are on finding people or the dead or missing in a few minutes.
Stay off 695, about 35,000 cars go through there a day. We'll talk about that. Brett, first off, on the President's Monday, we never see anything quite like it. Three major things happen. He goes into court, unrelated, and he tries to delay his Alvin Bragg trial. And he doesn't get it. It's going to be going on in the middle of April. Next, he finds out that his bond was reduced to $175 million. He says that's doable. And then Truth Social ends up being valued at around $3 to $4 billion. It could have been worse.
It could have been worse, 100%. Actually, overall, pretty good day. Obviously, that trial, the criminal trial, is going forward April 15th. But if you were going to have a trial go forward, that one probably is the one to do it. There's a lot of people, Democrats and independents, who think the legal justification on that particular trial seems a little stretched. So, you know, we'll see how it goes. It's clearly going to be a trial, a criminal trial, with the president of the United, former president of the United States, sitting there, and it will affect votes one way or another. Right now, the former president is right. It is only gotten together not only his base, but some independents who say this is just not right, what's happening.
So, you know, what's interesting, too, Politico did a poll, and they said Trump really doesn't lose anything if he's convicted on this crime. However, Politico says the poll found four times as many independents say a conviction would make them less likely to vote for Trump. So that's something to keep in mind. We did hear in the significance of the cases, the thing that people care about is the January 6th. Is that what you found?
Yeah, I think that one has the most resonance. I guess the documents case has potential too, but it seems like the Alvin Bragg case is the only one that's going to go before the election.
Washington Post did an editorial, and they basically said, you might not like Trump, but they did the right thing reducing that bond. It was excessive. And I was kind of struck by that. But that didn't stop the array of pundits for saying they're outraged by what the appeals court did. Cut five.
This is so infuriating, I don't even know what to do. I don't even know if I care what the process is that these judges are arriving at. Whatever it is, it's flawed.
Example 749 of Donald Trump rolling above the law. I mean, the notion that I would walk in there and have my what I owed knocked down to a third of the judgment is ludicrous.
Look, if you have the money, just go ahead and pay for it. Don't whine about it. It is a national security risk for someone to be this much in debt.
He and members of his family have been very close to Russian and Saudi interests, just to name a few. So this is a big problem that he has given longer to try to court this kind of money from who knows where.
There's no question that there is disproportionate justice for him in countless ways.
It's just not true. And here's what the Washington Post editorial says. Here's an excerpt. No matter how much one disapproves of Mr. Trump or wishes that his presidential ambitions fail, every defendant deserves due process, including recourse to appeal. That is even true with the former president, who are as unpopular in a particular jurisdiction as Trump is in New York, and even in civil cases such as one in question. Judges and juries seeking appeals should not be effectively impossible or expensive to the point of imposing the vast and irreparable harm. And that's what the 440 million would have done. So we'll see what happens now with the appeal.
Yeah, and listen, you could flip it around, right? And all those pundits who really did want to, it seemed, see Letitia James,
yes,
Headlock, one of the Trump properties. They just wanted that visual viscerally. And you could flip it around and say there is another tier of justice that he wouldn't have gotten this ruling in any way, shape, or form if he wasn't former President Donald Trump. And, you know, I just don't think that they looked through that glass. And it was evident yesterday in the reaction.
All right. So the other big story, I think, yesterday was the abstention and the UN demanding a ceasefire. That just set Netanyahu off. He's not going to be sending an emissary or a delegation here to the White House as we requested, even though his defense minister was here at the time. And they claim that just abstaining from this vote was not a big deal. Here's John Kirby. Cut 12.
Number one, it's a non-binding resolution. So there's no impact at all on Israel and Israel's ability to continue to go after Hamas. Number two, as I said in my opening statement, it does not represent a change at all in our policy. It's very consistent with everything that we've been saying we want to get done here.
That's not true, is it, Brett?
No, it's not true. And, you know, you look at that resolution and the inside of the resolution, it does not mention the word Hamas once. It does not mandate, it calls for the release of hostages, but does not say that has to happen before the ceasefire. It does not say specifically anything about what transpired. And listen, Israel, most importantly, takes it as a change in policy. And, you know, that reaction, they're blaming on just Netanyahu and politics. I think that that's going to be a problem politically for them with some corners of American Jews and some folks that really want to support Israel, even to limit it, they think that this is a change in policy.
So they don't want him going to Rafah. The vice president said over the weekend, yeah, that's a no-go zone. The President Biden has said it's a red line. But Brent, the prime minister and most of Israel, 85%, so you got to go into Rafah. How could you possibly leave the nucleus of Hamas in place? They'll look at it as a total victory. And I'll add something. Every time there's friction between the U.S. and Israel, Hamas gains leverage. Iran gains leverage. And it's going to make it harder for any type of ceasefire to take place and any type of hostage prisoner swap to take place.
Yeah, it's true. And look, if you look at it through the prism of Ukraine, some 6 million Ukrainians left, fled when Russia started attacking. They just left the country. The Palestinians in Gaza are not being allowed to leave the country, in part because they're being held there by Hamas. Another part is because there's no relief valve. Egypt doesn't want them because they don't want their own threat from Muslim Brotherhood. And so it is a unique scenario, but the onus is on Hamas. And that gets lost in all this back and forth.
Lastly, I know you talked to Brit Hume about it last night, but for people at home who don't watch NBC or MSNBC, there's a mutiny there of all their on-air talent. Doesn't seem happy that Ronna McDaniel is going to be there giving her Trump Republican perspective on the last 8 months before the election. Now, people were upset on January 6th that she didn't come out and say flat out the election was fair. And they just are outraged that she got a contract without checking with them. Here is to the recently deposed host of Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, cut 23.
There's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting, have been met with character assassination. So it is, you know, that's where you begin here. And so when NBC made the decision to give her NBC News' credibility, you got to ask yourself, what does she bring NBC News?
I can tell you, she'll give you a perspective from Republicans. What bothers Donald Trump's camp? What his real approach is here? What about a running mate? Who has the inside track? Who would you recommend? It makes the show better. Brent, you're in a fascinating spot because you've watched contributors come and go. Your panel is populated each day, and like if there's a new person, they all want to be on Special Report. I never thought that in public you berate your management at any level.
It's really bizarre, actually. And I, you know, listening to it, it's like you don't want to hear a Trump perspective, and she's not full Trump. I mean, she has pushed back to the Trump camp, but she could give you an insight into maybe how that camp is thinking about things, which is kind of invaluable as you get towards the election. I also think that it's pretty rich in that, you know, the Jen Psakis of the world are saying that they shouldn't do this. Chuck Todd was a former Democratic staffer, Simone Sanders, others. I mean, we have Dana Perino, Kayleigh McEnany, Ari Fleischer. There is a valuable insight for people who've been in those jobs to be able to give you some vision of what they're looking at on the inside. And I just think it's really interesting to watch this blow up. Chuck came out and said it's not about ideology and anybody trying to make it right and left is wrong. It's tough to not see that it's about Donald Trump.
And they're obsessed with January 6th. I watched the other channels on Sunday. I just want to get a perspective. It helps the radio show to get everything. So I watch, and every time a Republican is on, whether it's Nancy Mace, January 6th, where were you? What were you doing about that? What did you say about that? Why did you say that then? What do you say that now? Why would you support Donald Trump? Or if you're anti-Trump, you know, you'll have a prominent place on the panel. But every time someone comes on that is pro-Trump, and on January 6th, bad day, but people are overcharged, they will fixate on it. I don't know what audience they're playing to. It's imagine if George Bush, this is what I make it akin to, Brett, if George Bush every day talked about 9/11, George W., every day, okay, it was a bad day. But, you know, look at my response on 9/11, I got it. By the time we got up to him going against John Kerry for re-election, we would almost be numb to it outside the families directly affected. You just don't keep playing the January 6th card, but it's almost as if they have some type of PTSD to it.
Yeah, I think they think that that's the rich political ground to stir up, because, you know, that case, you know, likely is the most charged that could affect the election if it was coming before the election. Now, it doesn't appear that it is going to come before the election. Right. We'll see. But I do think that that's where a lot of folks are. Now, listen, we're not going to take away from that day. It was a dark day.
Absolutely.
And the people who did the bad things, the horrible things, they need to be, held accountable. But I agree. We as a country probably need to move on.
Lastly, the Republicans come apart. I've never seen anything like it. I understand the frustration of being the House minority. You really are invisible in so many ways, especially with Nancy Pelosi in charge. She wasn't even doing things in normal order. So I don't understand being in the majority and leaving. What is going on with this party? Mike Gallagher, the latest to leave instead of at the end of his term, at the end of the week. So do you think they could lose the majority before the summer's out?
It is possible. It is possible. And, if Democrats were smart, they'd be working to moderate Republicans and saying you can be chairman of X, Y, and Z. I mean, they're only a couple away from Speaker Hakeem Jeffries. Now, imagine if that happens, how dysfunctional Republicans would look, that they lost their majority without an election. The thing is, it is possible. It's not likely, but it is possible that that could happen.
Yeah, it'll be another unprecedented thing happening in our lifetime in real time. Brett Baer, we're going to watch you on Special Report tonight at 6 p.m. Is that okay?
I think you should do that.
All right, do it. Thanks so much. That is the great Brett Baer. When we come back, your phone calls, 1-866-408-7669. Bottom of the hour, Dan Senor, former foreign policy advisor to President Bush and Mitt Romney, and author of The Genius of Israel, just back from Israel. Don't move.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in freefall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This does, this is a significant movement forward. This is, of course, not the biggest of the cases that Trump has been facing. The hush money payments has been viewed kind of as the lesser case of these four that he has been facing in Florida and Georgia and Washington, as well as New York. But, it'll be interesting to see whether America really does tune in, whether there is any impact by there being an actual trial, whether we, see anything interesting when Trump does, in fact, face a jury in this case.
It's going to be interesting, right? 3 to 4 weeks, he can't do anything, which is part of the reason why, if I was Trump, I would just pick a running mate. I would start staffing up. I wouldn't just say you're my surrogate. I would say, no, I'm going to be the Secretary of Commerce. I'm going to be Treasury Secretary. I'm going to be Secretary of State. I'm going to be National Security Advisor. I'm going to be Secretary of Defense. And you fan out across the country. Talk to the president today. These are the policies we're going to implement. Not President Trump is the right man at the right time. We don't need that. I think you give people an image of what the cabinet will look like. More of an idea. Head to head, two governments. You decide what you want. No spin. Understand it. Would you like to see John Ratcliffe do a sit-down interview and maybe a town hall? Because you know he's going to be DNI, you know he's going to be CIA or something like that. Mike Pompeo, if he wants it, he'll have something really significant. Robert O'Brien, something really significant. But it'll also do two things. It'll get a message out there, be able to raise some money, and the president will be commanding a lot of publicity for people, haters and lovers, who want to find out what's happening in that trial. Those little pressers after will help him more than hurt him. All right, Dan Senor next. Inside the Israel-U.S. relationship, which is fracturing. Can it be saved unless there's a regime change on both sides?
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's a difficult job, no doubt. Unfortunately, what we see here is this administration trying to pretend that they're not placating to the political left, but they really are. This is a pretty critical change in our public policy as it pertains towards defending Israel's right for self-determination. There really is only two outcomes they have to pursue. Number one, they must eliminate Hamas fully and completely. Number two, they're not doing this for political benefit down the road. They're doing it to protect their citizens from future attacks.
So that was Cameron Hamilton, a Navy SEAL trained with the IDF. He was just going over why they have to go into Rafah. And that is something that the vice president of the United States says is a no-go. And the president said it's a red line. And he said, come over here. I want you to explain to me. And we have some ideas how you could have an alternative to going into Rafah and eliminating all of Hamas. One would be them a mass surrender. That should be brought up more. Instead, the president is showing that he does not like the prime minister. And the prime minister has decided not to send that requested delegation over to Washington, D.C. after the ambassador at the United Nations decided to abstain rather than object to the last U.N. resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. Dan Senor here, just back from Israel, former foreign policy advisor to Bush, Mitt Romney. And he's the host of a podcast called Call Me Back with Dan Senor. Dan, welcome.
Hey, Bri.
Your thoughts about this fracture.
First of all, I do want to clarify something. You said the ambassador to the UN decided to vote to abstain.
It's the administration.
Exactly. I just want to be very clear. This was a decision made by the president of the United States. In the recent weeks, there's been growing tension between the Biden administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu. They have repeatedly said, we have issues with the Prime Minister. We do not have issues with the Israeli government. We have issues with the Prime Minister. We do not have issues with the people of Israel. In fact, Vice President Harris explicitly said 2 weeks ago on CBS, it's important to separate how we think about the Prime Minister from, or the country's politicians from the people. First of all, that's an absurd thing to say. Israel's a democratic country. The people elect the government. The government's policy, actually, as you mentioned, I was just in Israel doing a talk about my book.
If you're Vladimir Putin, you could say, I like the Russian people.
Right.
I'm not a fan of
Putin. It's how the U.S. government talks about Iran. It's important to separate the mullahs from the people. But in Israel, which is a thriving and flourishing democracy, and right now whose policy, even though their particular politicians are unpopular, the policy they are pursuing in Gaza is not unpopular. I've never seen – as you mentioned, I was just in Israel. I've never seen a broader consensus on a policy in Israel.
What about going into Rafah?
Okay. So I'll get to that in a second. So they've repeatedly said separate the politicians from the people. This resolution that they deemed acceptable – and it's important to say, they say, no, we abstained – nonsense. When they have objected to resolutions in the past, they have vetoed the resolutions. This resolution they chose to let pass. This resolution did not condition a ceasefire on the release of hostages currently sitting in dungeons in Gaza. It did not. Okay? So for them to say, oh, our beef is with the politicians, not the people. Well, there are Israeli people in dungeons in Gaza right now, and you just greenlit a resolution that basically said – not basically, explicitly said ceasefire. Yeah, we should work on the hostage issue, but ceasefire, as opposed to saying no ceasefire until those hostages are released. Now, if you're Yahya Sinwar, who's the leader of Hamas, and you're making a decision right now about a hostage negotiation deal that would release another 40 hostages.
You got more leverage.
Yeah. You're sitting there saying leverage. Pressure is mounting. Pressure is mounting in Israel. Why do I want to cut a deal now?
They walked away from 40 hostages – for 700 prisoners.
Yeah, if not even more, yeah.
If not even more. And over 100 are in for life, which means they committed murder.
Right. Now, you asked about Rafah. So first of all, Israel is going to go into Rafah. I'm quite confident of that. When I was in Israel last week, I had a long interview with Ron Dermer, who's the Minister of for Strategic Affairs for the Prime Minister. I did a long interview with him for my podcast. I encourage
you. He was supposed to come here, right?
Yeah, he was supposed to be here. In fact, I was supposed to see him this week. He was going to be in Washington and New York, and the Prime Minister canceled the trip for him and Tsachi Hanegbi, who's his National Security Advisor. They were supposed to leave, I think, last night. He canceled the trip after this UN vote. When I interviewed Minister Dermer, you can listen to it on my podcast, he talks explicitly about they're going into Rafah, that they have no choice. In other words, they have to eliminate Hamas. You cannot have a genocidal actor on your border as a democratic country that just wants to lead normal lives and not eliminate that threat. So they're trying to do that. They're making tremendous progress. They can't do that. They can't do that without going into Rafah. So Rafah, there are four battalions in Rafah, Hamas battalions. They have to finish those battalions off. And the Israeli public, I got to tell you, Brian, again, I keep coming back to this, ideologically from right to left, politically, religiously, I mean, by any metric you use, the Israeli public is behind finishing the job in Israel.
Is there a corridor, a humanitarian corridor for the million people that are there? Instead
so
of
not,
the...
they're working on it, and they don't have a – that's one of the things they were going to talk about with the Biden administration this week is exploring ways to address concerns about moving people, the million-plus people. I don't know if you can move a million-plus people, but moving a lot of people from southern Gaza to the north. So they're figuring that out. But – and I think the administration can have a hand in helping Israel shape that policy. But the goal of going into Rafah has not changed.
I want you to hear what Kamala Harris said Sunday.
We have been – clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake. Let me tell you something. I have studied the maps. There's nowhere for those folks to go. And we're looking at about 1.5 million people in Rafah who are there because they were told to go there, most of them.
Did she study the maps, Dan? I mean, could she pick out Israel on that map? Could she pick out where Gaza is on that map? She's been studying the maps. General Harris.
I don't even know how to respond to that. I mean, it's just, you can't make it up. I mean, I've been studying the maps. It's not exactly Dan Quayle's misspelling potato, but there's an element to just this image.
Although, didn't he write a comprehensive missile defense pact with the Soviet Union?
Yeah, he was a competent guy that was
mislabeled.
No, I know. I don't mean to do that to Dan Quayle. No, I think as much confidence as I have in Kamala Harris's analysis of the maps, I would not have Israel make its security decisions that determine it how to deal with existential threats on her reading of those
defense
maps.
Minister Gallant was here yesterday, and when this meltdown took place, do you know if they made any progress? Because you know he's been acting on his own. Netanyahu is not doing LBJ and saying I want you to hit this block and this neighborhood and there. So the defense minister I hear is running the war.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And he's I know him. He's a very competent guy. He's a very impressive guy. He has a lot of autonomy, and that meeting he was already here when this UN vote happened. He met with Secretary Austin, he met with Jake Sullivan, he met with Tony Blinken.
Does anyone feel better about it after meeting?
I don't think I don't know how granular they got. We don't have a readout on it yet, but he claims it was a good meeting. So who knows? And Netanyahu, because Gallant was already here and doing meetings, Netanyahu obviously let it proceed.
So do you know who's extremely happy? The Ayatollah. He said that America is closer and closer to abandoning Israel, and we're closer to knocking them out of the region because now Iraq is voting on whether we're going to have a presence there. The Houthi rebels are making the Red Sea impassable, and now you see the fracture between the U.S. and Israel. So Iran is the big beneficiary of this.
Yeah. Look, all roads lead to Iran. These are all proxies of theirs. You mentioned the Houthis. There's Hamas. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's Hezbollah. I mean, you just go around. There's Syria. All these governments that we're talking about and all these organizations are proxies of Iran. I think Iran is playing a very clever game, which is they gin up their proxies to put pressure on the U.S. and on Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. and Israel respond to the proxies and don't respond to Iran. And at some point, the question is going to be whether or not somebody responds directly to Iran.
And let's see. Are the problems in the Middle East staying in the Middle East and the Far East? The answer is no. Because we left Afghanistan because we were tired of the longest war. And guess what we have now? The Taliban said, we're announcing yesterday, we're back to stoning women. And we know that women can't go to school past sixth grade. I don't even think they can get to sixth grade. But we don't care about that. We can't change cultures. That's what detractors say. And now we see Pakistan is bombing the Taliban back and forth. Now we see ISIS-K is fighting with the Taliban, which they, like Iran, Iraq, hope they both lose. But then you have ISIS-K blowing up Iranians at a memorial service for Soleimani and they're blowing up Russians. This is all the tumult that's come out of this region. We want to leave it behind and move on. Dan, you can't.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is after the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan in the summer of 2021, the Biden administration assured us we'd have over-the-horizon capabilities, that even though we don't have a ground presence there, we can kind of see from afar what's going on and we can do these targeted strikes, which it just
– we knew that's not true.
I know. It's not working and we're seeing evidence of it now. You know, you're seeing the – because the thing is with these ISIS threats, using ISIS as an example, it's a low-cost way. Like it's not costly for them to reorganize. It's not costly for them to cause troubles. We saw in Russia. So so that's the risk of this over the horizon strategy, which, oh, by the way, is a version of what the Biden administration right now is prescribing to Israel to do in Rafah. Why do you have to go in with a big ground force? Why not just
surgical strikes?
Right, exactly.
Which it's not possible.
Well, it's especially not possible.
Why is Hamas still there? Do you think they're still there?
In Rafah?
Has the wall been dropped in Egypt? Where they can't get out, so they're still there.
We don't know because, I mean, Egypt says the wall has been dropped, but you know, who knows? There's probably plenty of tunnels that nobody knows about. I do think there a big chunk of Hamas is still there because you're talking about 24 battalions in total, 18 to 20 of them have been wiped out, or seriously, you know, incapacitated. There are 4 battalions remaining, mostly in Rafah. That's a lot of manpower. It's hard to scatter that many people. It's possible that some of the leadership is gone. It's certainly possible. We know that some of the family members of the leadership have gone, but whether or not you can 4 battalions, that's a lot of people and it's a lot of equipment. And it's not so easy to just have them scatter.
That is true. So when you look at what's happening, do you think that from what you know, as horrific as October 7th happened, has Hamas been surprised by the level of retribution the IDF has put on them? Or do they expect all this?
I think we don't know yet, really. I mean, we get reports about intelligence. It's sort of uneven, the quality of the reporting. I do think Hamas is surprised by how alone they've been. I think they thought Hezbollah was going to come in from the north. And Israel suddenly find itself in a two-front war. My sense is they thought they could activate pressure on Israel in the West Bank. There's Hamas in the West Bank. They could activate pressure on Israel during Ramadan. So far, still a couple weeks left in Ramadan. So far, nothing or very quiet. I think they thought the international community would be able to rein in Israel's response, which they so far have not. We're now almost 6 months into this. So I don't know if they're actually surprised, but I would think they would be. If you look at their track record, right, if you look at Hezbollah's war in 2006, 34 days before the U.S. and the international community shut it down. You look at Israel's war in Gaza in 2014, about 50 days before the U.S. and the international community came in and told the Israeli government to shut it down. We're now 6 months into it. I don't think Sinwar and his leadership thought this would go on this long.
Do you think the U.S. is going to get to the point where they condition the aid that they give that so many Democrats are calling for?
No, I think I don't think they will go that far. I could be wrong, but I don't think they would go that far because it would really subject the U.S.'s relationship to a serious rupture.
All right. When we come back, a couple more minutes with Dan Senor. Also, keep it in mind on that Fort McHenry. Right by Fort McHenry is the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It collapsed when a barge hit it this morning. They're looking for 7 people and up to 20. Cars crashed right into the water about 1:15 in the morning. Construction workers were on the bridge at the time doing cement work. This barge seems to have lost power 2 or 3 times, regained it. This theory is with the black smoke, it indicates they tried to reverse at the last minute. The whole branch, it got hit. They hit a pillar. The whole thing collapsed. It is horrific. You would think it's a Schwarzenegger movie, only it really happened. That story and more. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'll be frank. I think the president is worried about losing Minnesota and Michigan. He's getting a lot of pressure from the pro-Hamas wing of the Democratic Party, a lot of activists and people like that. You know, he's getting heckled at speeches. He's hearing a lot of complaints. And so I think he's trying to have it both ways, still stick with Israel to some extent, but also do things that signal to these people and try to appease them.
And that is Marco Rubio. And that is him. I talked to him yesterday on Fox and Friends. He also did. I went to a very hostile environment on Meet the Press. But Marco Rubio is on the short list to be vice president. And if you ask me, I think he's going to be on a short list to be something in the State Department as Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. He did a lot with Venezuela, Central and South America. I know he's respected foreign policy. Rubio, as they try to point out, Jonathan Cole tried to point out, they used to be arch enemies like Ted Cruz. And they rolled some stuff from 2016 with Marco Rubio saying negative things about Trump. Yeah, it's called a campaign. You know who else? Obama and Hillary blew each other up for a while, too. With me right now still is Dan Senor. Dan, your thoughts in Israel, do they understand that the president is worried about losing Michigan and worried about losing Minnesota because of his stance?
Totally. Most Israeli policymakers think that is the primary driver. They think the president, as Ron Dermer told me when I interviewed him last week in Israel for my podcast, he said the Biden you saw in the days after the election, sorry, in the days after the attack of October 7th, the Biden you saw in the days after October 7th was unfiltered Biden. This is Biden recognizing the difference between good and evil. There are political advisors around Biden who want a confrontation between the U.S. and the Netanyahu-led government. That's not exactly where Biden is. And the political advisors are worried about exactly what you and Senator Rubio were just talking about, which is primarily Michigan, which is Biden can't get reelected.
He's trailing by eight.
Yeah, and he can't get reelected if he doesn't win Michigan. They fear that it's the progressive community, the progressive left in Israel, in the college towns like Ann Arbor, and the Arab community, the Arab American community, who won't turn out. I think this is political. Let's just say this is a political judgment that is just, to me, way off at best. At worst, it's total malpractice in terms of the advice he's getting. Look, if Biden tries to mollify those who support Hamas, he will alienate so many other voters. There's no mollifying.
Will Democrats ever not vote for a Democrat?
Well, the fear is that they will.
The American Jews ever not vote for a Democrat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. First of all, I think there's a potential this cycle for the American Jewish vote to be lower for the Democrat than usual. I think more interestingly, and I think there'll be some loyalty to the top of the ticket. I think down ballot, she takes a state like Pennsylvania. So Biden can't get reelected without Pennsylvania, and Biden can't win Pennsylvania without winning the Philly suburbs. The Philly suburbs, you're talking about, there's about 300, so about a little over 7 million voters in Pennsylvania in 2020. There's about 300 plus thousand Jewish voters. A lot of them are in the Philly suburbs. A lot of them are Democrats. I think you can see a lot of them vote for Biden and then say vote for Dave McCormick down ballot. So I think you'll see a lot of ticket splitting because of the Israel issue.
All right, Dan Senor, thanks so much. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan. I heard around the country, around the world, where sadly we lost a police officer last night. He actually is from my town. When he went over to find out why a car was in the bus lane, it turns out the guy in the passenger seat is a convicted felon, 14 different charges. He already served for attempted murder in jail, whipped out his gun and shot underneath the bulletproof vest. That's how bad things are getting. And for those people who are police officers or gets mad when police officers come up and they demand you do certain things about putting your hand on the wheel and they say, well, I wonder if it's because these guys are so paranoid and they think they want to be in charge. No, they're worried about it. There's no routine stop. Now more than ever, you never know where things are going to go right, especially in this era where we let all convicted criminals out eventually if we ever lock them up at all. This hour, we're going to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, Senator Rick Scott. He's in a tough race, get six more years. Veronica Majora, CEO of Alter Ego, a California-based company founded and led by Ukrainian women. And then we'll have a simulcast with Stuart Varney. Meanwhile, we're seeing Governor Wes Moore speak out and just confirm that the cargo ship that took out Francis Scott Key Bridge at 1:15 in the morning, where one person's been rescued and two people have been rescued and At least five more are thought to be, sadly, lost their lives, and many more because some went into the water. It's 48 degrees. He just said that they are confirming that the ship pilots were complaining about they have lost power, lost propulsion before they actually crashed into the bridge. There's no sign of any terror activity. With me right now is Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Colonel, I know it doesn't directly affect you. You worked in Washington for a while. Maryland's right there. What are your thoughts when we're seeing this video today?
Well, first of all, how horrific and tragic it is for those family members who lost their loved ones. They were just, you know, out on a bridge, and next thing you know, the bridge collapsed on them. And, you know, with the hypothermia situation, you don't have a lot of chances to survive at 48-degree water temperatures. But I think that what will have to happen is you'll go back and you'll look at, you know, whether or not they need to have pilot tugboats or something like that to assist these vehicles, these ships. When I was in Congress, we had the Port Everglades who were in the district, and I went out on one of the pilot boats and, you know, looked at their procedures for guiding in these cargo ships. So maybe I'm sure that they'll go back and look at their emergency operating procedures and how they need to make sure that they're escorting these vehicles, you know, these ships rather out of the port area and out past these civilian bridges.
Yeah, it's interesting. Tugboats, they were. I know very little about this stuff, but I do know some people that are on tugboats. They pull them in and out just to make sure, but they said that that's not cost effective, and there's never been a problem before. The bridge is over 50 years old. It was up to code, but the way it fell, like an erector set, was just really unthinkable. So we'll see what happens. It could be human error. It could be maintenance issue. They were only 30 minutes into a journey that was going to go over the course of 17 days with cargo. So, and they've been all around the world since 2015. Singapore flagship. So, Colonel, let's talk about what's happening with the Israeli-U.S. relations. Benjamin Netanyahu says, I'm not sending a delegation, obviously doing an abstention in the United Nations on a ceasefire measure was an insult to the Israelis. Have you ever seen relations between the two countries lower?
No, and again, this is all about politics. Joe Biden is looking at the uncommitted votes that he got out there in Michigan, which, of course, has the concentration of Dearborn, Michigan, where Rashida Tlaib is a representative, and she, without a doubt, has been a pro-Hamas spokesperson and you know, issuing a lot of their propaganda. But, you know, why would we put the pressure on our number one ally in the Middle East to, you know, let up on a designated terrorist organization that has killed Americans and is holding Americans hostage? We should be supporting their efforts fully and wholeheartedly to make sure they eradicate and eliminate that threat, which is Hamas, who in their charter says that they want to eliminate the state of Israel and all Jewish people, but not just in the Middle East, but anywhere.
Yeah. Here is John Kirby, Cut 12.
Number one, it's a non-binding resolution. So there's no impact at all on Israel and Israel's ability to continue to go after Hamas. Number two, as I said in my opening statement, it does not represent a change at all in our policy. It's very consistent with everything that we've been saying we want to get done here.
He knows that's not the truth. He actually, it's if, you know, there's no big deal. They just abstained, just went ahead with it. We didn't go sign off on the language, but it shows a break with your partner. And guess who weighed in on it? The Ayatollah says we are beginning to see a fracture between the U.S. and Israel, and soon Israel will be gone and the U.S. will be gone from the region.
And that's exactly what they want. And so he can sit up there and say that it's a non-binding resolution. It's the perception. And the perception that people are seeing there, being Iran, who is the number one state sponsor of Islamic terrorism, and they bankroll the Houthis, the Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, is that they see that fissure that is coming along. They see that fracturing, and they know that this is an opportunity. On top of that, they're very thankful that the Biden administration has been the ones who have really opened up their resources and once again filled up their bank accounts and not holding them responsible for the sanctions on their oil revenues. So they're very thankful for the Biden administration, what they've done.
All right, I just want to bring you to some of the Yeah, I just want to bring you to with this, some of the crazy things that happened yesterday. Pretty much a manic Monday for the former president, but it came out, and two-thirds of which came out good for him. Number one, his company goes public on NASDAQ. It's worth about $4 billion. I'm talking about Truth Social. It made him the top 500 richest people in the world. Number two, for so when President Biden comes out and calls him broke Donald, it's never looked more farcical. Number two, he found out that they put a $175 million bond on his company as he waits for an appeal on the civil case. Believe it or not, that's doable for him, and he's got 10 days to do it. So no theatrics with Letitia James and her padlocks. But number one, they're going to go ahead with the actual case itself. But when Trump came out, and people wonder why he was at the hearing, he didn't have to be, because he knew he wanted all the focus on here. He knew he'd come out and get all the cameras on him. And he keeps saying these are Biden cases, and they fact check him on the other channels, and they pull out of him. They said Biden is not behind this, but then he has proof. Listen,
we have violent criminals that are murdering people, killing people. We have drug dealers all over the place, and they go free and they can do whatever they want. But they go after Trump where there's not even a crime. And did you see the number of people were there? You had Colangelo and behind him. And remember this, Colangelo was a DOJ guy. He's a Biden DOJ guy. Why is he in the Manhattan DA's office trying the case? That in itself is a conflict. He's in the Manhattan DA's office trying the case.
So Matt Colangelo was a senior consultant with the campaign, and he served as Department of Justice in the Department of Justice under Biden. Before that, he was in the New York Attorney General's office. So as soon as he left, he goes over there. And next thing you know, Alvin Bragg's got a case. Nobody else had a case, but he's got a case. And that's what Trump says. It appears to him that Colangelo made it happen. On the other side, when you find out that Nathan Wade is meeting in Athens, Georgia with White House counsel, why would you be doing that if you care about Fulton County? And it was Fulton County's problem with the former president. So even if all these things are just innocent and coincidental, the appearance is terrible, and I don't believe in coincidences.
No, these are not coincidental, and it also reminds me about how everyone was chastising Donald Trump when he talked about the Obama administration conducting surveillance against his campaign in the early transition stages of his administration after he had won, and that came out to be true, even though the left tried to make fun of it. And so, yes, here once again, we see these collusion points. We see these coordinations between the Biden administration, Department of Justice, and these different respective district attorneys. And we know that these district attorneys are in areas that they think are going to be favorable to them against Donald Trump, New York, Fulton County. But these cases are falling apart. And I think more and more so, Donald Trump is gaining in popularity because people see this as political targeting.
I mean, Franklin said the other day, he said, are you guys idiots? Do you realize every time you do this, he gains popularity? He looked into the camera. He just left the CNN host aghast. So listen to the reaction to reducing the bond to one all-time record, $175 million. Cut five.
This is so infuriating, I don't even know what to do. I don't even know if I care what the process is that these judges are arriving at. Whatever it is, it's flawed.
Example 749 of Donald Trump rolling above the law. I mean, the notion that I would walk in there and have my what I owed knocked down to a third of the judgment is ludicrous.
Look, if you have the money, just go ahead and pay for it. Don't whine about it. It is a national security risk for someone to be this much in debt.
He and members of his family have been very close to Russian and Saudi interests, just to name a few. So this is a big problem that he has given longer to try to court this kind of money from who knows where.
There's no question that there is disproportionate justice for him in countless ways.
You know, I saw some lawyers to their defense. Some lawyers on other channels did say this is it's appropriate to knock it down 60%. Can you believe how outraged they are about something that's been unprecedented?
Yeah, it's incredible to me, because when you hear the one person that said that President Trump has connections with Russia and China and everyone, what about Hunter Biden and Joe Biden with China and Russia and Ukraine and all of the very nefarious business dealings? And then you have the other commentator that you heard said, I don't care about process. I don't care what these judges think. In other words, what the left is saying, they don't care about the rule of law. All they care about is rule, R-U-L-E, and their power and their control and their ability to be able to dictate things. And I did not hear anybody say anything, those commentators, when the decision was that we can't prosecute Joe Biden for not having access to classified material that he had in his home and places like that, because we're not going to go on with the prosecution. You want to talk about a two-tier system of justice? There's your two-tier system of justice. And furthermore, if Alan West had lied on a 4473 background check form to purchase a weapon, I would not be talking to you on your show right now. I would be behind bars. And why is it that Hunter Biden is not behind bars? Because that's what he did.
And by the way, the DOJ is looking into transactions linked to Jim Biden as part of a criminal investigation in Southern Florida, Florida and Pennsylvania. That has nothing to do with James Comer or anybody else. But I just thought when Tony Bobulinski came out and talked about direct links with Joe Biden, the meetings that they had, the interactions that he provided, whether it was print or in person, and he does all these things, and Bobulinski's sound is nowhere found on any of the networks, none of the channels, because they couldn't touch him. Even the AOC thing, well, what statutes has he violated? The RICO statute. He's like, RICO is a method, or whatever she said. Racketeering is not really a crime, I guess.
But in Fulton County, Fannie Willis is trying to bring up, Trump and others on RICO and racketeering. So they cannot have it both ways. They cannot say that there are rules for thee but not for me, but that is the mantra of these progressive socialists.
Right. And, Colonel, I want to bring you to the border. We have it totally broken, and every time we bring it up now, it's been brought up. They say, well, there was bipartisan legislation in the Senate. The Republicans just want the issue. They don't want it solved. What is your reaction to that?
No, the only person that can solve this is the person that sits in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. That's the person that gave 90-plus executive orders, unconstitutional, to undermine our border. And how shameful it was to see some 300 single military-age males charge our border, knock down the fence, and trample over our National Guardsmen, who, I got to tell you, I don't understand why they weren't armed, because they were put in a very dangerous situation. And now those individuals have been released into the country after being processed.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. Colonel, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Take care, Brian.
You got it. We come back, Senator Rick Scott. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news. Unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Senator Rick Scott, we are back in Florida. Great to have you on. Senator, I know you're battling for re-election. Still a tight race, I guess, with Powell on the Democratic side. What's your thought about pulling away this summer?
We're gonna win. I mean, look, this is the election is going to be about, do we want to secure a border? Do we want to get rid of inflation under control? Do we like Biden's economics? I mean, where people, if you look in the last 120 days, the country's lost 1.8 million full-time jobs. We're only adding part-time jobs. Look at what's going on with our relationships overseas, how he treats Israel. When Trump was president, guess what? We didn't have an open border. We had a good economy, great economy, and we didn't have all these wars going on around the world. So I'm just going to make sure everybody understands that if you want to vote for my opponent, you're voting for open borders, more inflation, a crappy economy, okay, and bad world relationships.
So one thing your governor's doing today is reforming the squatter laws. Squatting's happening, especially in Georgia and New York. At a dizzying rate, you leave the house open for 2 weeks. People just move in. It's impossible to get them out. People arrested trying to get their house back, changing locks to get their house back. You guys are staying ahead of the curve. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's actually happened where I live, down in Naples, Florida, and the police were able to get them out right away as soon as they caught them. But it's a big issue. I think I'm glad people care about it. And Florida is a state that people want to live in. You look at what they're doing to Trump right now in New York. Why would anybody invest a dime in New York? Not a dime. I know, Brian, you live there or you live in that area, but what they're doing to the businesses in New York by doing this, they're putting everybody on notice. Hey, we don't like your politics. You wouldn't go after your money. And this stuff is wrong.
It is, and a lot of big businesses are going elsewhere. And lastly, what do you think of Donald Trump's situation now? He's got the Truth Social that ends up being a big win. He has a $175 million bond that'll probably get him to the fall as the civil trial. What about this case? Will it affect his poll numbers either way in April? The Alvin Bragg
case. I think they're going to go up. People know this is just political persecution. I mean, they're only going after the guy because he's Biden's main opponent. And so this is what has got to stop in this country, right? We've got to have the Democrats should not be able to try to say, hey, I don't like you on the ballot, so I'm going to get rid of you. That's exactly what they're doing. They're saying they're using political persecution. I mean, Department of Justice is going after people. Why in the heck did they raid Mar-a-Lago, but they didn't raid Biden's garage? I mean, go explain it. I mean, they sit here and they do all these things, and they have no explanation.
Are you worried about Haitians? Are you worried about Haitians breaching the border?
Absolutely. I mean, Brian, what is Biden's plan about anything? I mean, he's appeased the Cuban dictator. He's appeased Maduro, appeased Ortega in Nicaragua. Haiti's falling apart. I mean, everything this guy touches falls apart, and they don't have a plan. So I've talked to the Coast Guard. I've talked to the Department of Justice. I want to make sure there's not mass migration into Florida. My heart goes out to what's going on right now in Port-au-Prince.
It's just not the way you do things.
Yeah. Our state.
We can't just let people in because their country is falling apart. We have to have our country, and I think you get that. Senator Rick Scott, thanks so much. And he's with Homeland Security and Armed Services. I appreciate it. We come back. Veronica Maduro, CEO of Alter Ego, California-based company founded and led by Ukrainian women. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back. In about 10 minutes, I'm going to go on with Stuart Varney, Varney & Company, talking about what's happening with Shohei Ohtani. Buried in yesterday's news was what's going on with him in gambling. Yesterday, he came out through an interpreter and said, never bet on baseball. I'm really disappointed in my interpreter. Okay. Pretty sure it's not going to end like that. And we'll discuss that and along with President Trump's court dates, which are a subplot to this whole election. Meanwhile, let's bring in Veronica Maduro. She is the CEO of Alter Ego, and she is the California-based company founded and led by Ukrainian women focusing on cybersecurity and drones. Veronica, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First off, Veronica, what difference has Iranian drones made on this battlefield?
So first of all, let me start maybe, with our company's background. And so we represent Ukrainian technologies, battlefield-borne, battlefield-proven in the U.S. and NATO countries. So the Shahed drones and the variety of Russian drones that we recently saw during the warfare in Ukraine, they made a difference because it's a dynamic hybrid war, very asymmetric and high intensity conflict. And the solutions that Ukrainians had to come up with are pretty dynamic. And that's why our company was born, because the amount of technologies born currently in Ukraine and the battlefield is just enormous. They're not even always patented. And so what we do, we handpick these technologies and we try to develop them to find R&D solutions for them and represent them for the U.S.
So what have you been doing? How have you gone through the U.S. Defense Department and gotten Ukrainian weapons?
So first of all, we started to participate. We publicly presented our company last year in Pentagon during ACI exhibition. It's a pretty very closed environment. It's an exhibition for professionals and for potential defense contractors and from governmental representatives. So we presented our company, our capabilities. So between the being publicly presented to potential buyers and potentially being defense contractor, between that step and actually being a defense contractor, there is a long way. So right now we're in the process of evaluation of our company and capabilities. But what we do, we constantly handpick technologies and that proven in Ukraine, and we try to redevelop them and to find better and our solutions to make them stronger and then more to have more chances to be used by the U.S. and NATO countries.
Right. So, Veronica, do you have to wait for this all this aid funding to be given to the Ukrainians for you to be able to get Ukraine these weapons?
So we do not provide weapons for Ukraine. So the way we work is we handpick the best solutions born in Ukraine and represent them for potentially DoD here. So that's technically what we do in terms of UAS and counter UAS solutions. When it comes to cybersecurity, it's a totally different situation because we technically represent so-called ethical hackers. Those are professionals, IT professionals, who are known for being a part of cyber army of Ukraine. So we represent those talents in the U.S. as well. So we do not supply weapons to Ukraine.
But you provide technology.
That's right.
Right. So tell me how your company got to be formed. It's all women.
That's right. That's right. So we all, majority of us came from actually from a nonprofit background. So previously we were working with the U.S. Department on campaign against gender-based violence. And we work with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And after the war started in Ukraine, a lot of our employees started to volunteer in Ukraine and became administrators for communication for cyber groups there. And at some point, we realized that, you know, naturally, Ukraine developed a mass amount of IT talents who volunteered their time, and they became part of cyber army of Ukraine. But as volunteers, they gained huge experience during the war in Ukraine that can be applied by U.S. or by NATO countries. So we formed a company to represent those talents for the U.S. And then we added also special military technologies. We started to work with the largest in Ukraine international military battalion called Georgian National Legion. They have almost 2,000 international soldiers and volunteers who are part of army of Ukraine. So we started to work with that international division. They have a lot of great inventions, and we started to represent and patent them in the U.S. So that's kind of how it was born.
What should people know about the battlefield right now in Ukraine?
Well, the information that we are getting from the front line directly is often really different from what we hear in news. So often we hear that soldiers on the front line, they're so underfunded and they need the basics, ammunition, provision, like really the basics. They're lacking the basics very often. So I can tell that, you know, from what we hear on the front line, that soldiers survive due to efforts of volunteers. So the biggest issue that we saw there is like Ukrainian army is being underfunded. And that's what we don't really read in news, but that's what we hear from the soldiers directly.
Right. Frustrating for you?
Very. You know, minding the fact that U.S. is sending so much funding to Ukraine and other countries as well, and hearing from the soldiers that they do not have warm clothes for winter, or they don't have enough bullets, or they don't have enough weapons to fight on the front line. That's very frustrating because, you know, then we have questions, you know, what's going on. Really.
Yeah, I find it unbelievably frustrating. And now they go see if they can get something out of the house, because you guys are the good guys in this. And clearly Russia is the aggressor. What's your take on the fact that they after that horrific terror attack on Friday, they're trying to say that Ukraine had a role?
I do think that it has a lot to do with Russia picking friends, and they're picking wrong sides often, right? So I think that they're facing consequences of that decision. So, for example, when the Israeli conflict started, right, Israel got cyber attacks enormous amounts. And the cyber groups who attacked Israeli systems, the hackers, were funded by Russia. So I think that, you know, making wrong decisions about who are your friends, this is what they're facing now. So Ukraine has nothing to do with it. But I have another point that, you know, it's not just kinetic war. It's a cyber war. And the cyber war started much before the physical attack happened in February 2 years ago. And what our company does, we also dealing with problems like human trafficking of Ukrainian refugees from the borders of Poland and Ukraine, and these refugees being often trafficked to Middle East countries, and technically they use cryptocurrencies to in human trafficking transactions. So what our company did, like end of last year, we started campaign crypto against trafficking because crypto transactions are not anonymous. And platforms like Binance, they store all the data about transactions. So technically, every crypto transaction is traceable. So what we're doing, what we did actually, we traced down some of the transactions related to human trafficking of Ukrainian refugees to the countries of Middle East. I'll not name the countries now, but this is another big problem that we're facing, the abuse of cryptocurrencies, abuse of cyber tools in human trafficking of refugees. And so this all happening because of the war, and there is a mass on the border, and sometimes the refugees that, you know, they just got trafficked, and cyber tools are actively, and crypto tools actively abused in transactions related to human trafficking.
Veronica Maduri, I love what you're doing. The CEO of Alter Ego, making a difference. Thanks so much, Veronica.
Thank you.
All right, when we come up, FBN, simulcast, Varney and Company.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney and Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Now, on the back end of this, keep in mind, Stuart Varney, we usually leave some end. We'll be able to get some calls. So you scramble up right now. We could end the hour with your calls. You always go on FBN and do a simulcast. We are understanding we're still following a bunch of stories, including the latest on the collapse of that bridge in Baltimore, thanks to the crashing of the a barge into it this morning. It turns out a power failure is part of what we're understanding is the reason why the barge took out the Francis Scott Key Bridge. We're still looking. We have two people have been recovered. One refused to get any medical care. The other one's in the hospital. We're still looking for five other people that happen to be working in construction. But let's listen in together.
Time, Brian Kilmeade with us this morning. Look, Brian, Donald Trump's trial starts April the 15th, and he's got to be in the court for the entire trial duration. In my opinion, Brian, that is election interference. Biden is keeping him off the campaign trail, keeping him in court. Election interference? What do you say?
Well, I'll tell you what. Out of all the court cases, the one that's really going to be in question, I think technically you're right. I think this is a case that's been simmering since, I don't know, 2015. It's an incident that happened in 2003 or 2007. And now here we are in 2024. Yes. Stuart, if you're upset by April, how are you going to feel about the documents case in September? How are you going to feel about the January 6th case or one of them coming up in October? Jack Smith has every intention of doing that. So I think it's a problematic in April. But it's going to be a huge issue in the fall. And the one thing I would do if I was Trump, he gets a lot of publicity, all the cameras in between trial takes when he walks in and out. That helps him. Maybe not with independents. It helps him. But what I would do is I would name my cabinet. I would name not only my running mate, I would name my cabinet. Because Trump can't be everywhere. He needs the team that Joe Biden's got. You know, Gavin, he's got all the governors fanned out. He's got all his people fanned out. You know, you're going to see all these people campaigning for him. I would see John Radcliffe's going to be in there. Robert O'Brien's going to be in there. You know, maybe, you know, who knows, Jason Chaffetz will be in there. Other people that he's talked to about joining him, like Marco Rubio and others. Give the American people a sense of what your government's going to look like if you elect Donald Trump, even if he has to sit in court. And I thought it was pretty effective yesterday when he came out and just said, listen, the direct link to President Biden is this Department of Justice official who joins Alvin Bragg, and suddenly there's charges in New York at Donald Trump.
It stinks. Brian, I want to change the subject. L.A. Dodgers star Shohei Ohtani spoke out for the first time after his former interpreter was accused of stealing millions to pay his gambling debts. Watch this.
So on a personal note, I'm very saddened and shocked that someone who I'm trusted has done this. So I never bet on baseball or any other sports, or never have asked somebody to do it on my behalf. In conclusion, Ipe has been stealing money from my account and has told lies.
Okay, that is the new interpreter speaking right there. And he said, look, Ohtani has never bet on baseball. Do you believe him?
Pete Rose was commented. They came up to Pete Rose and said, how do you feel about that? He said, well, you know, if I only had an interpreter to speak through, I never would have been banned. And that's just it. He set the bar pretty high for himself. Never bet on baseball. Never placed a bet. He stole from me. Okay. Just so you know, if this is the case and he stole from you, he's going to jail. If he didn't steal from you and he was betting for you, he's going to talk. Nobody goes to jail for 10 years who doesn't usually do hard times, if not. He also, how is it that with his team, the guy's worth, got a contract worth $700 million, the number one player maybe in all sports, pound for pound, certainly the biggest name in baseball, even though he doesn't speak a word of English. How is it that with this entire team around him, someone could take millions of dollars out in your name, use it for unsavory practices, nobody notices until they raid an illegal bookmaker in California where sports gambling is illegal, and then it goes back to Ohtani, and then this story becomes a story thanks to, I think, the LA Times and USA Today and ESPN. So I'm a little, if this is all true, good. Congratulations. You're the most naive person in the world, and somehow you gave your buddy the power to spend millions of dollars without you knowing it. But if not, you got it. This guy's looking at a ban. You lied like Pete Rose. You gambled like Pete Rose. And at least a year suspension if he lied. And I just don't think people are going to stop investigating it. A lot of people were incredulous about that press conference and no questions afterwards.
It's going to go on forever. And this is the last thing that baseball needs at this moment. Kilmeade, thanks a lot, Brian. We'll see you again real soon.
Go get him, Stuart. Thank you. So just to back on the Ohtani thing, as the Wall Street Journal writes today, there are obvious questions as to how the interpreter could have allegedly accessed and transferred millions from Ohtani to alleged bookmaker without attracting attention from Ohtani, one of his representatives said. It remains unclear why Ohtani's reps, confronted with questions about the bookmaker, chose to present a contrite interpreter with a story of Ohtani covering for gambling debts and how they could have done this without first running it by Ohtani himself. So that's what they're talking about, the story change. They played a game over in Japan. They come, or Korea, I forgot which one. They're back. Dodgers are back. And then he was laughing with the interpreter on the bench while all this stuff was raging. I don't know about you, but the first time someone stole $4.5 million from me, if it does happen, and it's going to be a miracle if it does happen, I think I'd be angry. I don't think I'd be laughing on the bench with him. And I will say this. If you gamble, you want to win. And if you want to win, do you gamble on soccer and basketball and maybe football? Or are you in the locker room with the most famous player in baseball in California? And are you talking to teammates? Are you talking to other members? And you're hearing about injuries. You're hearing about problems in the dugout. You're hearing about managerial changes. You're hearing about somebody's arm being sore and pitching that night. If you're gambling and cheating one of your best friends in the world out of money, to me, you're trying to win. And one of the things this interpreter says is when I started to lose, I started to double down because I wanted to win the money back and forget about it. And to do that, do you try to see who, do you try to predict who's going to win, Manchester City or Manchester United? Or do you ask some of the angels what they could tell you about other teams in your division? All this stuff is going to be traceable electronically. And if it gets deleted, that's almost a sign of guilt, too. More spotlight on Pete Rose, too. I mean, he commented yesterday, sooner or later he's going to sit down and say, what about me?
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Garrett Ventry is coming up a little bit later, founder and president of GRV Strategies, former senior advisor to Senator Chuck Grassley. A real hold on which the Republican Party is heading, both the traditional one and the Trump movement. Andrew McCarthy standing by, too. We're also following the latest on the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge after a barge slammed into it. Now it turns out that they said they lost propulsion, they lost energy, they lost power, and that's what caused the collapse of the bridge. We are searching for six people. They recovered one alive, and he is in the hospital. Before we get to Andy McCarthy, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting.
But we've also said election deniers is not just they can do that on our airwaves, but that they can do that as one of us, as paid contributors to our sacred airwaves.
That is a meltdown. Ronna McDaniel, hired at NBC, caused a massive network mutiny, and I just don't get it, but happy to watch and learn.
Number two.
Number one, it's a non-binding resolution, so there's no impact at all on Israel and Israel's ability to continue to go after Hamas. It does not represent a change at all in our policy.
Not true, and he knows it. Biden breaks with Israel, and Netanyahu breaks with Biden. At stake, peace in the Middle East. Who's happy? Our enemies, Iran, China, Russia. I have the details.
Number one.
All of these different cases, so ridiculous, the cases, every one of them is ridiculous. They're all trying to damage Trump as much as possible. It's having the reverse effect, but maybe someday it won't. I don't know. But it's having the reverse effect.
There you go. Donald Trump, much to the chagrin of his detractors. Former President Trump has more than survived his manic Monday. His bond reduced. He can make it. True Social goes public. He has billions more in his bank account. But he will have his first criminal trial on April, beginning on April 15th with jury selection. Andrew McCarthy joins us now, Fox News contributor, former assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Andy, you got a shout out from President Trump yesterday.
Yeah, I was a good guy yesterday, so I could be a knucklehead by the end of today. So who knows?
Right. You call it as you see it. You thought it should have been reduced, right?
I really think that, Brian, if you're just concerned about assuming New York State prevails on appeal, which I don't think they will, but let's just, for argument's sake, they do. Trump's company is under monitoring now.
Yeah.
And his biggest asset is New York real estate. So it's not like Tish James will have a problem finding things to execute on if she, you know, down the road, the appeal goes her way. And under those circumstances, I could understand a nominal bond. And look, if it's like $100 million, that's not really
nominal.
That's not nominal in absolute terms, but in terms of what a normal bond requirement would be. But why does Trump need to post much of a bond when he's got all this real estate? It's not like he's got, bundles of cash that he could put on a plane and take out of the country and go someplace. The real estate in New York is not going anywhere. There's a monitor in place to make sure that he doesn't, dissipate his assets. So I just don't see that this should have been as controversial as it was.
So the Washington Post editorial section, I'll just give you an excerpt, because this might seem like another example of courts helping Trump escape punishment by exploiting the judicial system. In fact, it is appropriate. It is an appropriate ruling that will revert potentially unjust harm to a citizen who could prevail on appeal, at least in reducing the size of the gargantuan fee bond. No matter how much one disapproves of Trump or wishes the presidential ambitions fail, every defendant deserves due process, including recourse to appeal. That is true even with former presidents who are as unpopular in this jurisdiction as Trump is in New York. And even in a civil case such as the one in question, judges and juries are seeking appeal should not be effectively impossible or expensive to the point of imposing vast and irreparable harm. They also say few appeals result in a reversal of the lower court's judgment. I want you to get that line in, too. Is that true?
I think, you know, probably on the whole, most civil and criminal cases get upheld on appeal. But, you know, that's like a 30,000 foot view. Every case is different. And here you have a case that, unlike the vast run of cases that go up on appeal, Brian, this case is an unprecedented use of a statute where there was no jury to be sort of second guess the judge. So he made it up as he went along. He contends that he knows better than like Deutsche Bank and other financial institutions that had skin in the game, what interest rates should have been charged and what coverage rates should have been charged. This is a very novel case. It's a, you know, they took a consumer protection statute and they applied it out of that context and in the context of big bucks financial transactions where the players on both sides are very sophisticated financial actors. I think the Court of Appeals may have a very different take on this than Judge Engoron did.
So the president brought up, he said, what is this? The other networks just tune out. As soon as President Trump says his links, these are Biden lawsuits. As soon as that happens, when Trump says that, they all bail out and they say he's lying. Well, then you see Nathan Wade have two meetings at least that he invoiced for with White House counsel in Athens, Georgia. We don't know what Fannie Willis did. We know she met at least with the vice president one time. And now we have a situation where this guy, Matt Colangelo, who used to be with the Department of Justice, is now with Alvin Bragg and leading this case. Listen to President Trump yesterday.
We have violent criminals that are murdering people, killing people. We have drug dealers all over the place, and they go free and they can do whatever they want. But they go after Trump where there's not even a crime. And did you see the number of people were there? You had Colangelo and behind him. And remember this, Colangelo was a DOJ guy. He's a Biden DOJ guy. Why is he in the Manhattan DA's office trying the case? That in itself is a conflict. He's in the Manhattan DA's office trying the case.
What's your thought about that?
Regret. When I think back, when I was a young prosecutor in New York, I was on the federal side, but across the street was the Manhattan District Attorney's Office of Robert Morgenthau, who was an institution in law enforcement in New York, U.S. attorney for many years before, for decades being the Manhattan District Attorney. And I think Bob Morgenthau would not have cottoned to the idea that he needed to recruit people from outside because his office wasn't competent enough to handle their own big cases. I must tell you that, you know, having worked for many years while I was a federal prosecutor with state prosecutors in task force arrangements and cooperative investigations and the like, there's nothing illegal about the federal government working with state governments, but they're supposed to be transparent about it. And what I see going on here is the same thing I see with Biden and Merrick Garland's appointment of Jack Smith, which is that they're trying to coordinate the lawfare campaign against Trump without having their fingerprints on it.
But are those fingerprints? Is Matt Colangelo fingerprints if he leaves the Biden Justice Department and goes to Alvin Bragg?
Well, I think it is. I mean, he was a very high-ranking person in the Biden Justice Department. It doesn't mean that Biden is calling the shots in Bragg's prosecution. But what it does puncture, I think, Brian, is the claim by Biden and his Justice Department that they don't have it, that Biden himself and his campaign don't have anything to do with the lawfare crusade against Trump. I just think that's wrong.
Right.
And there was reporting in Politico, was it like 6 weeks ago, that Biden was annoyed at Garland because he thought that Trump would have been basically convicted and sentenced by now. He doesn't understand why it's taken so long.
So I want to talk about the actual case, the Alvin Bragg case. They got to pick, it goes to jury selection April 15th. Do you expect that to happen? And if so, How important is jury selection? Will they have a pool in New York City that could actually be unbiased about Donald Trump either way?
Yeah, well, I'm not as confident in a state jury as I would be in a federal jury. And the reason for that, Brian, is like when I worked in the Southern District of New York in Manhattan, we drew a jury pool from Manhattan, the Bronx, and northern counties, including Westchester. So you got more of a broad mix. This is the Manhattan Criminal Court. So you are going to get a jury only of people from Manhattan, which is very hostile to Trump. It's like Washington, D.C. level hostile to Trump. It doesn't mean that you won't get a handful of jurors who would be sympathetic to him. And it doesn't mean that jurors can't tune out their political leanings and decide a case fairly. And there's a lot about Bragg's case that I think to normal people will be offensive. But, you know, it's not, let's put it this way. It's not a home game for Trump. It's going to be a tough trial for him.
I mean, how hard can you work a jury and just say, listen, there's nobody here that's not biased. I mean, if you are the defense attorney, I'm always shocked how quick jury selection goes. But to me, that's the case, isn't it?
Well, it's a lot of the case. The thing I think that the dynamic that's very important that people don't take enough notice of is what goes on between the judge and the jury. The jury takes a lot of cues from the judge and how the judge conducts a case. And there's a lot of that that's kind of body language that doesn't necessarily come out in the transcript. But, you know, if the judge is hostile to Trump's lawyers and seems to be embracing the prosecutors, well, we'll have to see how he behaves himself in front of the jury, right? But, you know, that conveys a signal to the jury about what the court thinks of the case, which can be a very powerful impression on them. So I think this is a very hard case for Trump. Because I think his best defenses, which, you know, when the former president talked about the column that I did at National Review over the weekend about Bragg's case, I think there's very strong arguments against Bragg's case, but they're mainly legal arguments. Like, for example, the idea that he doesn't have authority to enforce the federal campaign finance laws, which he's trying to do under cover of this New York business record statute. Now, I think that's a very good argument. I think it could be one that an appellate court will reverse on. I hoped that Judge Merchan would give it more of the time of day. He seems to be a rubber stamp for Bragg. But it's a legal argument. It's not one, you know, the jury's not going to hear about Bragg's jurisdiction or the statute of limitation. The jury's going to hear about hush money and Michael Cohen and how Trump kept his books. The day-to-day of how the case comes in front of the jury is very different from the legal issues that envelop it that may ultimately end up in getting the case thrown out, but that'll happen on appeal. It's not going to happen at trial. And what I hope is that the jury will see that what Bragg has done here is taken – this is a jury from Manhattan where they have a very significant crime problem. They will see that the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is spending gobs of money and resources – on a nonviolent business records misdemeanor type case that Bragg has turned into 34 felonies if Trump were Osama bin Laden. I think a common sense juror looking at that would be offended by it, but we'll have to see what happens.
I guess we'll have to see and find out about those documents. Either way, it's going to start April 15th. Joe Tacopina is out. The new team is in. Are you convinced that he's well represented?
Yeah, I think the problem he has is probably going to be similar to the problem he had in the civil case, which is, you know, I think the judge may be very friendly to the state lawyers. And that's a lot for even the most competent defense lawyers to overcome. But from what I can see so far, they seem to be, you know, they're doing a good job. It's just that they have, you know, they have a judge that seems to have bought wholesale what Bragg's theories of the case are, and they haven't seemed to get much traction with them. And that, to me, that's kind of what happened with Judge Engoron on the civil side.
So just real quick on the Jack Smith side, they're going to hear immunity on both sides. Does the president have immunity? It's going to be a tough win, if the president's got to come from behind to win that one. Not many people expect him to. But if they'll in June, they'll decide whether the president has immunity or not. After that, Jack Smith will go, okay, let's go to trial. Can he just do that?
If Judge Chutkan lets him, yes. Now, two things on that quick. I think Trump is going to lose on the immunity. It's not certain, but I think he probably will. But much more important than the immunity is the obstruction case that the court will hear in April and will decide on in June. And if they throw out that obstruction charge in connection with the Capitol riot cases, which I think there's a good chance they'll do, that will mean it'll have to go in the Trump case as well. And it's central to Smith's indictment. So to me, much more important from Trump's standpoint is the obstruction issue than the immunity issue. The immunity issue delayed things, but the obstruction issue may actually harpoon a lot of Smith's case.
Right. So a separate hearing on whether the president can be charged with obstruction?
Well, the president is charged with obstruction. It's a 4-count indictment, and 2 counts are the same obstruction statute that the Supreme Court will consider in the case involving the January 6th rioters. And what I'm saying is the argument for applying that obstruction statute is much stronger, in my view, to applying it to the rioters than it is applying it to Trump, because what you have to show is whether people had corrupt intent or not. And I think it's a lot easier to conclude that someone had corrupt intent if they say, you know, take a flagpole and hit a cop over the head with it, versus what they've accused Trump of doing, which is basically Trump is said to have had corrupt intent because he argued John Eastman's legal theory that Pence had the authority to invalidate electoral votes. And as I think I've said to you before, if we're now going to take the position that a frivolous legal theory is a felony, when I was a prosecutor, I could have charged 6 felonies a day.
Thanks so much, Andy McCarthy. So complicated. That's the times we live. Andy McCarthy, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, we've got a few minutes on the other end. Garrett Ventry will bring us inside this campaign. Well, Donald Trump is winning in every battleground state, but for how long? That's the question. We'll discuss it on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey guys, Matt Thrash here, enjoying some March Madness with my great friend Pete Rose. And we were talking about the current goings on in baseball right now, and Pete wanted to mention something.
Well, back in the 70s and 80s, I wish I'd have had an interpreter. I'd be scot-free.
And then he's talking about Shohei Ohtani, who yesterday just basically threw an interpreter and said, no questions, never bet on baseball. I'm very mad at my friend Phil Betrayed. He spoiled $4.5 million for me. Left while there are people asking a lot of questions and only speaking Japanese, he claims to not be able to understand it. I don't think people are going to let up on this. I don't care what baseball decides to do. If he didn't do anything, then it's no problem. If all of what he said is true, you're right. It's over. But for judging by what we saw during the steroid era, what we've seen before through Pete Rose and him being less than honest about it, when we see the way this thing starts and the way they end up, precedent says we're not getting the whole story. And I know baseball doesn't want anything to do with this. They're not responsible for this because sports gambling is more challenging than ever. But it's illegal in California. They are in California. That sports book was raided. This guy, Matt Cowley, and he was got all his paperwork. They're going to see about these signatures. They're going to talk to the bankers. They're going to talk to the people that okayed the line of credit and the wiring of funds. And we'll see if the story holds up.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This does, you know, this is a significant movement forward. This is, of course, not the biggest of the cases that Trump has been facing. The hush money payments has been viewed kind of as the lesser case of these four that he has been facing in Florida and Georgia and Washington, as well as New York.
But, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether America really does tune in, whether there is any impact by there being an actual trial, whether we, you know, see anything interesting when Trump does, in fact, face a jury in this case.
Yeah, we'll see. Will the numbers budge if he's convicted of anything as opposed to being charged? When he gets charged, he wins the primary. When he gets charged, his numbers are up in almost every battleground state. But what if he's convicted? And what case? The word is, the theory goes, that the case that will hurt him is January 6th, that these cases are not taken seriously around the country, and even independents aren't paying attention. I did see a poll this morning that's a little bit different than that. Let's say it's Garrett Ventry. He's a founder and president of GRV Strategies, LLC, and former senior advisor, Senator Chuck Grassley. So, Garrett, what is the going theory that you look to or what you subscribe to most when these court cases, this one's going to get started April 15th?
Yeah, I mean, I think the cases at the beginning were a wild card, right? People thought this could be bad for him. It clearly helped him in the primary. He's already the Republican nominee very quickly. I think when you're talking about a general election, I did see Harvard-Harris polling, which came out, which shows essentially he's still up in these races when it happens. Depending on the case, the documents case, he's still up on Biden. So, I mean, these things are going to play out. You also have the question about how many of these are actually going to be decided potentially before or after the election. That's a lot of it as well. And the DOJ really has to look at this. You remember when, FBI Director James Comey in October with the October surprise, the left freaked out when he announced, you know, an investigation to Hillary at that time. How much more would there be a freak out in our electoral system? Just generally speaking, if you announced, you know, charges against a nominee a few weeks before an election. So I think that's a question that still remains.
Charges or a court case?
In terms of actually like being convicted, I should say, to be clear. So if you convict a major party nominee a few weeks before an election, I mean, that's pretty standard election interference, in my opinion, right before an election.
Yeah, a couple other things. Here's what Harry Enten said about the most intriguing thing about this election, arguably, is Hispanics. How Trump has gotten him, that Romney couldn't touch him, McCain was nowhere. Yeah, the first term, George W. Bush did his work in Texas and earned his keep, got around 40%. Since that time, it's been going the other direction until Trump burst on the scene. Here's what Harry said.
Look at where we are today in a Marquette University Law School poll that was put out last month. Look at that advantage that Donald Trump has on immigration and border security. It's near 30 points. This is a tremendous change that's going on. And it's no wonder that Donald Trump is running on immigration. And he's not just running on it in a Republican primary. He's running on in the general election. And I also think that's why there hasn't been quite the backlash that you might expect over Trump's comments, some of which that I, of course, wouldn't make. And it's because that voters at this particular point are quite concerned about immigration and they trust Donald Trump on this particular issue.
Do you think Republicans have lost ground when they walked away from the Langford-Murphy deal?
I don't think so. The reason why is that, there was a lot of provisions in that bill that Republicans, frankly, just did not like. I also think you're looking at one piece of legislation here versus, you know, 4 years under Joe Biden with essentially an invasion of our country. You're talking about 9 million people are here illegally. You know, you've seen the death of, you know, many young women from illegal immigrants who should have been deported because they're dangerous criminals, should never have been here to begin with. And catch and release and sanctuary cities have caused this. So you have a lot of folks, I think, that are concerned there. And you continue to see Republicans just have a stronger hand on handling immigration. I also think back to the interesting point on Hispanic voters is Trump's message here has been less of the Romney, Bush, McCain message. It's been more of this working class message. And I think it's really appealed to Hispanic voters here. And I think they're the most, you know, when you talk to, you know, I've talked to voters in Arizona, voters in Nevada, when you talk to like border state first generation immigrants who came here legally, did it right. The thing that makes them most annoyed is people coming here illegally, right? They went through the proper way of actually becoming a citizen.
And over 100 countries representative, you can only say, oh, Hispanics are at the border. That's not the case anymore.
Exactly. No, you're having, you know, there's 20,000 something Chinese nationals. You've got people from all over here, like you said here. So it's clearly, we just don't know who these people are. That's the big problem here. America's always been a great place to say, hey, if you want to come here legally, join the culture, contribute, be an American. That's a beautiful thing, and we welcome you. But this is, you're talking about 9 million people. That's bigger than the state of New York, Brian.
So right now, Republicans, according to his political Ipsos poll, found that if Trump was convicted in the Bragg criminal case, which I think is just ridiculous,
right,
almost four times as many Republicans said it would make them more likely to support him. But what about independent voters? There's certainly evidence they don't see it Trump's way. The political poll says that many independents said a conviction would make them less likely than more likely to vote for Trump. We know his numbers have been strong with independents. The poll showed Trump leading Biden going into, before any conviction, 43-27. I mean, that's pretty significant. So obviously they're just polls, but they're snapshots. Take what you want. They're not the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, so Trump's doing a good job with independent voters right now. Obviously, the conviction question, you know, until it actually happens, it's going to be really tough to actually see what that is. It's a moment of time right now. As you said, the Bragg case, I think, is the weakest case for him. You're talking about raising misdemeanor charges to a felony charge. It's essentially a nuisance
to extend the statute of limitations.
Correct, exactly.
Over an incident that may or may not have happened in 2007.
Correct.
About an election that took place in 2016.
Correct. I mean, all of that, when you say it that way, it sounds really bad for Bragg. Plus, you're talking about this is the same guy who supported cashless bail and crime three streets down from where we're sitting right now and just letting dangerous criminals back on the street. So if he's, you know, it's like he's letting all these felony charges go, and then, you know, you want to elevate misdemeanor charges against the political
opponent. The WABC listeners right now know about what happened last night. We have a 31-year-old police officer who saw a car stuck in a bus lane. He walked over and said, guys, what are you doing? They reached over and they shot him underneath the bulletproof vest, and he died. And he still tried to wrestle the gun away from him while dying. And he did this, and it turns out this guy has had 14 separate charges. He's had two stints in prison, one for attempted murder. Why was this guy out? Only in New York.
No, absolutely. I mean, they roll out the red carpet if you're a criminal here. It's absolutely ridiculous. With sanctuary cities, with cashless bail, these type of things. I don't know any citizen. I talk to my Democrat friends. They don't want dangerous people on the streets. So it's wild that these DAs and these politicians want dangerous people on the streets. I don't know who the constituency is for that. It's absolutely ridiculous.
So, you know, sometimes things happen and the issues become come to the candidate, you know, the election.
Right.
If war is a problem and John McCain's your candidate, you're probably pretty strong.
Right.
If the economy's an issue, then maybe it goes more to the businessman. It looks as though Joe Biden is doing the best he can through circumstances and decisions to throw this club more and more to Trump. If you see the way the foreign policy has fallen apart, the border has fallen apart, where the economy, inflation is yet to be tamed, the interest rates are so high. These are things that Trump worked. He go, listen. It's not me hosting The Apprentice saying this is what I will do. He's like, just compare it to the previous
right.
4 years.
Right.
There's a lot going on. I mean, look at Haiti right now.
Right.
And now that's hitting Florida.
Right. No, you're right. I mean, it is hitting Florida. You're seeing it. You know, you're seeing it in from Palm Beach, Jupiter, Miami, Tampa. You're seeing it all over the place. So I do think you're right here. And the thing that Trump has going is usually when you're facing a candidate like Biden, you're saying, here's what I would do, believe me. With Trump, you could say, I've actually done it before, like you said.
Recently.
Correct. Because a couple of years ago, look back, your 401k was better. The border was more secure. There were no new wars. You know, crime wasn't an issue the way it was. And, like, the economy was better not only just for average Americans, but for Hispanics, for women, for African-American individuals. The economy was just red hot and doing a great job. And so Trump has a contrast here to say, you know, my 4 years were much better than Joe Biden's 4 years here. And voters believe that. Your Fox News polling shows that, you know, recent Fox News polling, it said majority of people essentially think Biden's policies hurt them. Majority of people think that Trump's policies help them. That's what an election comes down to.
Right. And then when you have, for example, Trump has been more of a friend to Israel as a Republican than probably any other president.
That's right.
George H.W. Bush, 41, didn't really get people doubted his allegiance to Israel a little bit. Obama never bought into Netanyahu, actually tried to affect the election.
Right.
President Biden and Netanyahu have basically had a fracture, and Trump is sitting there, no, I gave you the Abraham Accords. I told you to go take the Golan Heights. The West Bank, I said, I'm not going to stop you. I'm going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. So it's pretty strong there. Here's what Marco Rubio said is the reason why Biden's now leaving Netanyahu. Cut 17.
I'll be frank. I think the president is worried about losing Minnesota and Michigan. He's getting a lot of pressure from the pro-Hamas wing of the Democratic Party, a lot of activists and people like that. You know, he's getting heckled at speeches. He's hearing a lot of complaints. And so I think he's trying to have it both ways, still stick with Israel to some extent, but also do things that signal to these people and try to appease them.
I know it must be unnerving to be losing Michigan. I get it.
Yeah.
But there's this thing called being a leader and doing the right thing. And we like to think that the Washington, JFK, making tough decisions, admitting when you're wrong, is what you're supposed to be cut out of when you become president. You should not be flipping foreign policy because of your poll numbers in a state in the spring.
Yeah, and that's absolutely what he's doing, right? Marco Rubio is absolutely right here. You saw all these uncontested votes here. You saw hundreds of thousands in Minnesota and into Michigan. And that's a big problem for him, because when you're talking about running uncontested and someone's getting, you know, some random uncommitted is getting 10, 15, 20% of the vote, that's not a good thing. But it is really disgraceful when you think about it, that one of our strongest allies is, you know, at war with dangerous terrorists who flooded into their country and killed women, beheaded children, you know, raped women, the vile acts that they did. And we're sitting over here like turning on them in the middle of war. It's like Senator Schumer's speech. Absolute disgrace to come out on the Senate floor and say you need a change of leadership in the middle of a war. And I think you're seeing, too, is that there are, you know, a lot of my friends that are Democrats that are Jewish are looking at this and they're not happy with Joe Biden and with Democrats' leadership right now. So it's a double-edged sword for Democrats right here.
Yeah, what's very interesting is that John Kirby said, we'll decide our own foreign policy, thank you, when it comes to using an abstention at the UN Council measure that we abstain from rather than objecting to, vetoing. And I'm thinking to myself, really? Last week, Senator Schumer just called for Israel to have elections.
Right.
But now you're getting defensive on one thing because they're being critical of you.
That's right.
I find it pretty stunning. Listen, have you gone on NBC, CBS, CNN?
I've been on CNN a couple times. I go on NBC, you know, probably like once a week or so.
Are you resented?
It's actually, I mean, for me, it's actually it's a respectful dialogue. I've seen what's obviously happened with the former RNC chairwoman. I've not fortunately had that experience, but I've seen how she was treated from some of the commentators there.
I watched the one-on-one, and then I heard this, cut 19.
And look, there's a reason why there's a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting, have been met with character assassination.
But we've also said election deniers, is not just they can do that on our airwaves, but that they can do that as one of us, as badge-carrying employees of NBC News, as paid contributors to our sacred airwaves.
The person who is the head of the Republican Party during Donald Trump's time in office and during his effort to throw out the election result and stay in power anyway is Ronna Romney McDaniel. The fact that Ms. McDaniel is on the payroll at NBC News, to me, that is inexplicable.
Now, I know they're obsessed with January 6th.
Right.
But do you think James Carville saw the other, had a great practice of seeing the other side? He's been a commentator for 50 years. I don't know. I see a lot of Ari Fleischer is thriving here, thrived at CNN.
Right.
I see that Diane Sawyer used to work for Richard Nixon. You have Jen Psaki,
right?
Clearly was not telling the truth with Joe Biden. So what's going on here?
Yeah, and I think that the best, you know, even when I do Fox too, it's, I think the best panels are when you have a Republican and Democrat, and both your viewers hear both standpoint. You could disagree with the viewer, but you know what they think, right? And the viewer's smart enough to say, I like that guy or I like that guy, right? It makes for good informative discussion. I do think it's very odd here because, you know, CNN.
It's like I'm missing it. I don't get it. I don't get the anger.
It's just like the Fox out. It's like the you know, it's a hoax outrage kind of thing, right? You have, you know, think about it. You had Stacey Abrams bless the airwaves of CNN for 2 years saying she was the governor of Georgia. No one cares, right? You had, you know, the former governor of Virginia refused to accept two elections by George W. Bush, and he was a CNN contributor, right? So, again, this is a – it's a rules for me, rules for another one.
Hillary Clinton said he's an illegitimate president.
And
Donald Trump knows he's an illegitimate president.
Right. And so you had all of this here, and you had these same networks, you know, MSNBC, and I've got friends that work there. I'm sure they're great people. But they pushed this idea that the president was a Russian asset without evidence for like 2 or 3 years. And it came out that all of this was a complete hoax, right? And so we saw them push that. And, again, you had Jen Psaki on there. It's just like these are what people do. They spin for their politician, their political organization, and that's just part of politics.
Right. I'm just stunned by it. Number one, I just said the whole hierarchy. You get hired. You don't have to clear your other hires with me.
Yeah.
I would never be arrogant enough to say to my management, change your decision. That's just not the way I was brought up, whether I'm working as a guy putting away at a liquor store or a gym. I don't rise up against my management.
It's not even privately. It's on air. It's remarkable. It's like you're raising it privately. It's your
going
on air to 3 million people.
Airwaves.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not yours. You got hired. You're expendable. I always thought.
I don't know what sacred airwaves are. That's a new one. Like this is the Vatican.
I don't know how she keeps the job. Do you?
I don't know. I saw an article today from Variety that they're going to kind of make that decision today. I don't, you know, listen, I don't know Rana that well, but I think it's, listen, it should be good for their viewers. You have someone who was the RNC chairwoman who's very connected, who has the Republican standpoint of view. So you have the Republican standpoint of view going into an election. You'd think you would want that perspective, and you could push back on her. That's fine. That's just journalism. Yeah. But I do think, unfortunately, they probably will cancel her.
Garrett, great to see you. Garrett Ventry, founder and president of GRV Strategies. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Just a quick reminder, April 27th, I'll be in Henderson, Nevada, the History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour, Green Valley Ranch, Grand Event Center. Jimmy Failla tells me it's fantastic, right outside the Strip. So go to BrianKilmeade.com, VIP opportunities, too. It's a lot of fun. We talk about this country. It's a very patriotic, fun night, and I look forward to seeing everybody in person. Tickets are selling well. So I know it's a month away, but get your tickets now. Hey, Bill, listen on WABC. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Brian, how you doing?
Good. You buying the Ohtani story? You think it's done?
No, you know what, Brian, I have a question. I don't know if it was in the article or not, but did he file any charges against his interpreter for grand larceny?
I don't think so.
I mean, that's a lot of money.
Don't you think so? I mean, not for a guy that makes $700 million, maybe, and if it's gradual. But, Bill, I mean, this guy, how long can he just say, I'm not taking any questions? I mean, about?
Well, that would be one of my major questions. Why haven't you had your friend arrested, or not a friend, whatever he is?
But I mean, I just don't think the Dodgers are going to get away with this. You know, Pete Rose is going to. He already spoke out once. I wonder if he gets aggressive now. And I just, if the guy just got $4.5 million stolen from him by a guy he trusted, if banks signed off on this, it would be a first in my lifetime. I knew it. And if all his other people turned their back. And look the other way or just missed it, okay. But I think there's maybe a 15% chance this is the story. 15%. And I think when you go through the bookie who got arrested, that guy has no incentive to cover up for anyone. Do you agree?
I agree, totally.
All right, we'll see. Maybe the Yankees dodge a bullet by not getting him. And the Mets run for him, too. Bill, thank you very much. And by the way, opening day this week, I think on Thursday. So we're getting closer and closer. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here. Go to BrianKilmeade.com anytime you want and get all this stuff, including the Stay Within Yourself shirts that are capturing America's imagination. Don't move.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.